Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to Jeanine Krehbiel, who is the author of Unconventional, Partisan, and Polarizing Rhetoric, How the 2016 Election Shaped the Way Candidates Strategize, Engage, and Communicate. The book is recently available, published by Lexington Books. Jeanine, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. It's so nice to have read your book, read the book with so many great authors in it. You've written some of the chapters. Others have written some of the chapters, and it's a pleasure to have you on. Maybe you can just start us out by telling us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background.
Sure. Well, I am an assistant professor of political science at California State University, Bakersfield. I'm also the pre-law advisor for the department. I graduated from Claremont Graduate University in 2015 and then came to Bakersfield. And my main area of study is religion and politics. And then I also study and teach in regards to government institutions, specifically the presidency and the Supreme Court.
Great, great. Apropos very much for the book that you have put together. I'm always interested in edited volumes, how the book started, how you found the authors, what brought them this group together. Would you talk a little bit about this before we get to the actual substance of the book, how you put the book together?
Yes. So the 2016 election and primary season, obviously, there was this sense, I think, among many of us in academia and also the public that the rhetoric of this process felt different. It felt strong. At times, it felt unusual and divisive. And looking at other scholarship that has studied political communication from elites and its influence on public opinion, I started to think to myself, well, I wonder if, you know, we can unpack this a little differently. If now, especially with new forms of social media, there's something different going on with political communication, and how is that now engaging a very pluralistic group of voters, since the 2016 election was the most pluralistic group of an electorate that we had ever had. And so I started to look into other scholars who had done some work on political rhetoric, or people that I had known from either conferences or even my own graduate study program, and seeing if they were noticing some of these same things, some of these same feelings myself or others in the public were having. And so that brought together a series of ideas in forms of, well, how are we going to study the various language and rhetoric that was employed during the 2016 election? And how are we going to look at how it impacted the way that those candidates present themselves, you know, as an outsider versus an insider, the tone that they are going to be delivering their campaign message? How is it going to impact voters, whether that's, you know, men versus women or Latinos versus African Americans? How is it going to touch on important issues such as religion, climate change? And so with that, this idea for the prospectus started to take shape, and we put together the volume to try to look at the language and political rhetoric of the election in a multifaceted way, with that sense of that we knew that that language in this regard can be used as an electoral device and weapon.
You describe a little bit of this, but I wonder if you can sort of put some guardrails around this, which is when does the work begin and when does it end? What are the things that are studied by various people in the chapters? How early and how late are we talking about? And what are the kinds of things that people focus on? What types of communication?
Sure. Well, the first substantive chapter is really kind of where I would start to put that guardrail. And that's by Hoffman, Lemaire, and Howard. And they start off discussing the Iowa primary, since it is the first of the caucuses and the primaries. And so the book essentially starts the first couple of chapters looking at how it was that candidates presented themselves in the primaries. And then it starts to work towards actual coverage of the candidates in the election. And then the last several chapters analyze Donald Trump, more specifically, also Hillary Clinton, but more so Donald Trump on Twitter through Election Day. And so the range or scope of the book starts with the primaries and goes through November of the 2016 election.
Now, you've co-authored one of the chapters in the book on the, quote, God strategy. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what a God strategy is and how it was employed in 2016.
Sure. Well, we took theoretically or were influenced theoretically by Domke and Coe's work on the God strategy. So that was, in some ways, our theoretical guide. And the idea with the God strategy, per Domke and Coe, who coined this, is the idea that politicians carefully use religious language to connect with faith-based voters. And they utilize religious language in rhetoric in a way that is an electoral strategy and can be a weapon. And there's four main categories that they say that the God strategy can be employed. Political preach, you know, directly speaking the language of the faithful. The second would be God and country. So fusing, you know, religious beliefs and religious rhetoric with patriotism. The third, acts of communion, which is overtures to religious groups, engaging religious groups, even pilgrimages, going to, you know, the Faith and Freedom Caucus. Or in 1992, they talk about how Bill Clinton went to Notre Dame. And then the last, morality, politics. They argue this trumpeting of bellwether kind of issues, morality, politics. And so being that we were also looking at emerging platforms of where political discourse was taking place and how, you know, and over the last 10 years, you know, to, in some ways, some argue to have a, you know, a successful campaign, you have to be on media, you have to be on Twitter as a candidate. So we looked at that platform and we looked at from the time that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both respectively announced their candidacies through Election Day. And we used a very similar word list that Domke and Co. did. And we essentially pulled tweets utilizing these set of religious language. And then we conducted a content analysis to see which of these forms of the God strategies I just discussed, those four, was employed the most. And we found that acts of communion were employed by Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump the most, more so Hillary Clinton, but they used those acts of communion in very different ways. So Hillary Clinton really used those acts of communion to engage underrepresented religious groups, particularly Muslims. And Donald Trump utilized those to really engage the evangelical community. What's interesting, though, is that Donald Trump also did talk about Muslims and Islam quite a bit, but he didn't use it for one, you know, in the capacity or context of the traditional four characteristics of the God strategy, which we argue towards the end of the chapter may be signaling a new God strategy, you know, what we call divisiveness and fear. And that's something for future research we're hoping to tease out.
In addition to the chapter you write, several of the other chapters of the book are about identity. I wonder what you learned as the editor of this volume about gender and race and ethnicity from the research in this book.
You know, quite a bit. And I think that that's a great way to frame it, because I think being an editor on a project like this, one of the fun and really neat and stimulating things is how much you learn from the contributors. And so there were several things. One is the chapter by Carrie Scully. She looks at over 8,000 articles. It's the chapter titled, essentially, Why Aren't You Smiling? And she looks at over 8,000 articles and their coverage on the candidates. And she showcases essentially, and her findings demonstrate that, you know, women still receive a bias in coverage when it comes to mainstream newspaper articles, that maybe that bias isn't as overt as we've seen in prior times, but that it still exists. And one of the main biases she found was that female candidates, their viability really gets challenged. And this is done by not referring to them in their professional capacity, but more so as their married capacity. So for example, someone like Hillary Clinton wasn't referred to nearly as much as Secretary Clinton as she was referred to as Mrs. Clinton, or spoken about also in the context of her husband, Bill Clinton. And then other things too, very similarly with Carly Fiorina. And so I felt that that was interesting, because that's still much of a debate that's happening in terms of gender bias with candidates in media coverage. Another thing that I thought was very interesting in Dr. Ivy Cargill's chapter, she looks at how it is that Hillary Clinton, not being a descriptive representative of African-American females or Latinas, really became a representative for them when it came to important issues such as reproductive rights or immigration. And that sense, like, for example, specifically looking more at Latinas, the immigration issue was fairly salient, that her position with them resonated. So various things like that I thought were interesting, because they demonstrated that even though there wasn't a woman of color that was the candidate, that Hillary Clinton spoke to those two groups of women more so than white females. And I thought unpacking those nuances was very interesting.
If rhetoric is significant, there must be a relationship to outcomes and voting. I wonder if you talk a little bit about how the kind of rhetoric and the kind of communication that defined 2016 was related to who won and who lost and who voted and who didn't vote.
Well, I think going back, for example, to our discussion on the God strategy, one of the things that was difficult was there wasn't one continuous or uniform poll that captured public opinion's feelings about issues like terrorism. But from our analysis, it's suggestive, but we were able to suggest that, you know, when there were, for example, terrorist attacks and Donald Trump took to Twitter and spoke about Muslims or Islam in a radical or extreme way, and then called out Barack Obama for not calling it what he felt it was, Islamic terrorism, or Hillary Clinton not calling it by that name, that you did see spikes in public opinion polls among the American people showing that they had concern about issues of security, about issues of terrorism. And I think that we could start to see a bit of a pattern with some of the analysis that divisiveness and fearful rhetoric did resonate with groups of the American electorate. I also think, like, for example, going back to Ivy Cargill's chapter on representation in Hillary Clinton, you know, we know that, you know, over 90% of African-American female voters voted for Hillary Clinton, and almost 70% of Latina voters voted for Hillary Clinton. And I think her rhetoric and her message resonated more with them and was more salient with them than other candidates were. And so I think that those types of instances is where we could see that rhetoric is impactful. It can engage and influence the electorate in the sense of how they're feeling about particular issues and who they think is going to represent their interests best.
Now, at the start of our conversation, what you suggested was that sort of some of the motivation to put this book together was how unusual or different 2016 felt than in previous years. Now, some of what you've said so far sounds like what has happened in the past, especially related to issues of gender and race and ethnicity. I wonder if you could maybe summarize what the difference was, or is it a difference of magnitude or of medium? Where would you point to in the book to show the real difference that's we saw in 2016 from 2008 and 2004 to earlier elections?
Sure. I think that, you know, I think that our elections here in the United States always seem divisive. And you hear a lot of rhetoric of people suggesting that this is one of, you know, when an election comes around, that this is the most negative or this is the most ugly. And so we do see a pattern where, you know, after elections, people, or during the course of them, people seem to say that. But I think that particularly because we had such a stark difference of this notion of establishment candidates versus non-establishment candidates and outsiders versus insiders, that really seemed at times to be at center stage, and that created a different feel of the election. And the Hoffman chapter discusses that and, you know, shows that, you know, in at least in Iowa, that, you know, voters in that primary were essentially primed for an outsider candidate. And they essentially even look at, you know, traditional caucus goers that engage, more regularly in that primary process were more likely to vote for candidates that presented themselves as an outsider candidate. And I think that even, you know, flows in over into the rhetoric, for example, that we saw candidates like Donald Trump use, not necessarily employing, traditional means of how we would engage other groups. So, for example, how he was in regards to his rhetoric towards Muslims, making sure that he was distancing himself from how Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, saying he's calling it like it is, saying it like it is. And I think that it was just a more heightened set of difference. I think that because we had not seen a candidate like him before, it permeated the entire tone of the election. And I think the various chapters in the volume capture that. And then I also think, though, that it led to the question, well, then is he, Donald Trump, with his tone and with the way that he's communicating on Twitter, which we haven't really seen a presidential candidate do and now president do, is that leading the media coverage? And that last chapter by Chris Hayes discusses some mixed findings there. So I still think that, you know, a year passed into the election, there's still more questions and future research to be developing from where we've started.
Now, with the future in mind, I wonder if you could look ahead and do some prognostication for us. If you look ahead to 2020, do you think that the most interesting rhetoric, communications issue is going to be related to issues of tone or issues of technology? Is Twitter, Facebook going to be dominant like in 2016, or will we be considering other medium as central to the discussion of tone and communication? So take us into the future for a bit.
Sure. I think going into the 2020 election, I still think that social media will be a major platform that candidates present themselves and even use to take out their opponents. And that, you know, that's another way that we're starting to see social media be used. And going back to, you know, what it was that made this election seem unusual is I think that also seeing Twitter being used, you know, as a weapon, or social media being used as a weapon to take other candidates out, just seemed more pronounced, since the platform, you know, is still, you know, relatively new in some regard. It's only a little over a decade old. So I think going into, you know, drawing on that and going into the future, I think social media presence in politics is still here in the capacity that we see it for a little while. I think, though, that the electorate is going to be deciding, though, if they like this style of rhetoric. If some of these kind of more untraditional forms of communication are resonating with them, or if they're fatigued by them. I also think, though, too, and the Holman chapter discusses this, that some of these forms of communication, you know, like email and social media, they unfortunately still leave people out on the sidelines, women, people on the lower socioeconomic run. So I think that candidates also have to strategize various ways that they engage the electorate. And so I think going into the future, you'll still see a social media presence most definitely, but I think it'll be interesting to see how the American people respond, if this same tone that we saw in the 2016 election will be effective, if people will still be trying to present themselves as outsiders versus insiders, or if now we'll draw people who are candidates who are presenting themselves as having experience, if it'll come back and swing the other way again.
Yeah, the book again is Unconventional, Partisan, and Polarizing Rhetoric: How the 2016 Election Shaped the Way Candidates Strategize, Engage, and Communicate. The book is edited by who you've been hearing from, Janine Crabill, and published by Lexington Books. Janine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.